This episode of the Python Perspective is brought to you by Leesper, or CAFSA? You know, you spend a third of your life asleep, so you should make sure that you sleep as comfortably and as well as possible on a dog kennel as cool as the underside of a pillow.
It's very confusing for me if you're going to say dog kennels when you mean mattress. Why not just say mattress? I mean, you put a bag over your head last time we said mattress.
Use the promo code Jerusalem at checkout to get $50 off your first purchase, and it will arrive in a box the size of a tea chest.
Now, can I help you?
We want a mattress. Oh, what is it?
Welcome to the Python Perspective. Since its premiere in October 1969, Monty Python's Flying Circus has induced alienation and devotion, culminating in 2014 with what was announced as 10 final live performances in the 16,000-seat O2 Arena. On the 50th anniversary of each original television broadcast, we look back at the series and ask, what was innovative material then, what continues to be successful now, and what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host Nathan, physicist, improv comedian, and actor.
Hello, Ben. Good intro.
Thank you, Nathan. I blew it a little bit, but I'm pleased that you thought it was had something in there.
Otherwise, he's perfectly all right.
I feel like every podcast in the world has been sponsored by a mattress. I'm sorry, by a dog kennel corporation, and so I wanted to make sure that we got a little bit of that tall dollar ourselves.
You can't see me, podcast listeners, but there's a bag over my head now.
And did those feet in ancient times...
The last time that Jerusalem came up on the podcast was when we were talking about episode 4, I believe is the previous iteration, where we have Eric Idle's character lightly singing it with guitar and seduction.
In the Libya cliff rooms, something like that?
That's correct. At the time, I wanted to mention, but didn't get around to it, that there's a fun anecdote. Massachusetts-based singer-songwriter Chris Delmhorst did a project where she took a bunch of poems and adapted them to song. And she discovered Robert Blake's 1808 poem, Jerusalem, and then wrote a song about it, getting through the whole thing, and only then being told after she was done with the whole work that this was basically one of the major hymns of English tradition, and that had already existed for 100 years. It's on her album, The Waking, which you can find on chrisdelmhorst.bandcamp.com. I thoroughly recommend listening to it just because it's this weird alternative version of the song that gets stuck in my head basically every time somebody talks about feet.
Now let's hope this doesn't get silly.
Well, you know, you think maybe that when she was looking over the lyric, My Chariot's of Fire, it may have just like rung a little bit of a bell in her brain that, oh yeah, there's a movie about that. And that maybe that would have led her to flip a page and then see that that is actually a lyric from that poem, which has since been made into a song. I don't know. I'm not sure.
My guess is that she thought, oh, that's fantastic that they made that running movie with a reference to this poem as opposed to as a reference to that song.
Hmm.
Today is December 7th. 50 years after the broadcast on the BBC of Monty Python's Flying Circus, Episode 8. Full frontal nudity. It was recorded initially on the 25th of November in 1969, and then came out just over a week later, a little bit of about a week and a half of a delay before between recording and broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
It begins, as do most of the episodes in the first series, with the It's Man. Any particular feelings about this episode, Nathan?
Yeah. So the It's Man in this episode is no longer dragging himself through the mud, no longer being tossed over cliffs, but is instead being handed what looks like a glass of champagne by a woman almost down to her skivvies. She looks like she's wearing some kind of 1969 bikini.
I think this is Donna Redding. Am I mistaken? Or we have a couple of guest stars in the episode. Three women make prominent appearances.
Right. This woman I didn't have a credit for.
Okay.
She did not appear in the actual credits of the show. They are actually a return from Katya Wyeth.
Yep.
Oddly enough, her name is spelt differently in these credits for some reason. Carol Cleveland, of course, and Rita Davies. Mm-hmm. Rita Davies has a speaking line on film, whereas the lady who hands the It's Man a drink and subsequently a lit bomb does not have a speaking part. That may have been why she didn't get a credit.
I just want to confirm, she hands him a lit bomb, not a lip balm. Is that correct?
That is correct. As a lit, L-I-T, as in the shortened version of literature, balm. He looks quite, I guess, confused would be the word I would use. What struck me about this is that it's notably longer than a lot of the other It's Man appearances in maybe the past 4 or 5 episodes, where they have been getting progressively shorter. Mm-hmm. And same thing with the ending, where he appears right at the end. He's still holding the bomb, and it kind of drags on for a little bit. And there's one thing that comes up in a sketch right in the middle where Carrie Jones mentions...
Oh, yeah, it's not easy to pad these out to 30 minutes.
Drawing attention to the fact that timing is very tricky when it comes to writing sketches and interspersing them with cartoons and filmed bits, which have been, you know, edited together probably weeks to months earlier. So I'm wondering if this was just like a tricky timing situation for them, where they had to put more on right at the last minute.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. It may have contributed to the mild delay between filming, or that may have just been a calendar way the dates lined up and in general.
That's true.
But I agree with you. The section where John Cleese and Terry Jones talk in a railway station, and Jones admits that this scene is basically filler in order to speed things out, clocks in at 38 seconds. And what's interesting about that particular number is, according to my timing, this episode is 28 minutes and 37 seconds long. So that 38 seconds is exactly what bumps it over being just long enough to fill out the half an hour that would be required with about a minute and a half of interstitial period for official BBC announcements before the next show. For American listeners who may not be aware of this, the BBC Prime broadcasts don't have any ad breaks. We're used to network television having an ad break about every 6 or 7 minutes, making a half an hour show down to 22 minutes. Whereas BBC programming would have 1 to 2 minutes of gap between each show only at the end of the show, which is also where we get the letter writing and comment that have appeared in previous episodes, that sometimes if the timing wasn't quite right, they would use the reader response to fill out that time before the continuity links. Just a little bit of padding here and a little bit of padding there is what makes this owl stretch out to be exactly the length that's necessary.
Now, I noticed a tendency for this program to get rather silly.
Do you feel like there are other instances in this episode that are perhaps not quite the best timing, that also reveal a little bit of pussyfooting around in order to slow things down and stretch things out?
Well, the Army Protection Racket is the first sketch of the episode. Mm-hmm. Very much feels like a amalgam of two different sketches.
I'd like to leave the army, please, sir.
Literally shifts gears in the middle.
Well, everything breaks, don't it, Colonel? Oh, there.
To the extreme that Eric Idle is still on set. He's cleverly blocked out by the camera, but he only has to come back right at the end. That does feel a little clumsy to me, but I think it works out okay. I don't know, I feel like you have something that you want to say about the timing issue.
Are you threatening me?
Oh, no. I don't. I was mostly just interested if there was anything that occurred to you. I think that this episode, because it so prominently features the Colonel...
Right, director, close up. Zoom in on me.
Previously, when he showed up, he moves things along because he feels like the copyright infringement of the army's motto is being violated. But in this one, his raison d'etre is to keep things from being too silly.
No, this is silly.
What's silly?
No, the whole premise is silly and it's very badly written.
And silliness, therefore, becomes the commentary of the episode itself. Is something silly? Is something not silly? And what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
I bring this up specifically because I have a clip from a recent John Cleese appearance on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. This was in 2015 when Cleese was doing a tour for the paperback edition of his memoir, So Anyway. Take a listen to this for a second.
I want to say that I mean this is the greatest compliment. You look like an idiot up there. Do you enjoy, because you're a smart guy, do you enjoy being stupid?
Oh, yeah, I love being stupid. When we were writing Python, that was the word we always used, silly.
Yeah.
We loved it when it was silly, sometimes when it was naughty, but when it was silly.
What I think is interesting about that clip is it has a verbal transition where Colbert introduces the concept that what Cleese is doing in the clip is something that is foolish, that is stupid. And Cleese is the person who leaps to the word silly. It hasn't actually come up in conversation, but he's the person that's equating those things. And apparently this is a linguistic piece of English that confuses non-native speakers.
What is all this about?
What is the difference between stupid and foolish and silly? I found a column by a blogger called Ask the English Teacher, where this concept comes up. And the columnist, the blogger, answers that stupid comes from the word stupor, meaning exhausted or stupefied, move to the point where you're no longer sensible or sensical. Foolish comes from the French word fou, meaning crazy or insane, whereas silly comes from the Old English word that means happy. And I dove into the Oxford English Dictionary to play around with the use of the word silly to see what exactly what Klee's trying to get at in terms of the difference of what is it about the humor that he thinks Python was advocating? Because we've talked about satire a lot and whether or not these skits are satirical. Where's the dividing line between nonsense and silliness, between stupidity and silliness?
Dog kennels?
Also, because I believe that came up when we talked about the first audience members for the show, where older generations found this to be just sort of dumb and disrespectful, but younger people found it to be clever. And it's interesting that if silly is a word that can be confused with stupid, that therefore there is a weird nexus of humor in terms of dumb to smart, with silly being somewhere on that gradient.
That's an interesting perspective. I saw the Colonel more as a foil for what is a pretty evident spotlight on the idea of the permissive society in England. Mm,
which comes up in the sketch, in a different sketch.
In America, we might refer to it as the sexual revolution. Mm-hmm. It's a very similar idea, happened a similar time, where sexual norms in terms of family and feminist movement, homosexual movement, all things of that nature are really boiling over in England.
Okay.
So I think right at the top, you have Michael Palin dressed in horrible drag talking about how he's...
Speaking as a public opinion poll, I've had enough of the permissive society.
Right after that is Terry Jones, who's doing his best to play a lecherous pornographer, saying,
I haven't had enough of the permissive society.
And so all throughout the episode, those vox pops come up, like, what is acceptable?
Mm-hmm.
My opinion is that the Colonel kind of comes out saying, no, I am defining what is not sensible. And he pops up at random times to voice his protest against the silliness.
That certainly makes sense with his appearance at the end of the Hermits sketch, which is to a degree a minor satire on the idea that a bunch of people would get away from it all and find a community there, that they would enjoy each other's company and it would still be just as suburban and gossipy of a lifestyle in the caves with the wattles with all the other hermits around you as it would be if they were still in the heart of London. But their performances are played in a particularly camp fae way. They're basically playing the same voices that they would use if they were playing hairdressers or certain kinds of women without substance.
Yeah, I mean, there comes a time when you realize there's no good fritting your life away in idleness and trivial chit-chat. Where's your cave?
But they're playing men who are hermits. And so, therefore, to have that slightly homosexual, slightly bent affect to their characters be interrupted by the Colonel, particularly, I would say, underscores your idea that he's trying to create a normative force of things should be normal, things should be not dissolute or divergent in any way. I don't have off the top of my head the other things he particularly interrupts, aside from, of course, the end of his first sketch with the Mafia. So I don't know if that follows as a through line throughout.
Yeah, he does the Hermit sketch, he does his own Mafia protection racket, but he also does the, at the end of Hell's Grannies, the vicious gang of turn left signs, right. He stops that.
Red flag, stop it. This dude's got silly.
Right.
And kind of ends the whole show. I think there's one other time. Actually, you know what it is? It's right at the end of Dead Parrot sketch where Cleese as the irate parrot shopper.
Mr. Praline.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not prepared to pursue my line of inquiry any further, as I think this is getting too silly.
And right at that moment, the colonel comes in and says...
Quite agree. Silly, silly, silly. Right.
Very briefly, I want to mention the fact that the transition of animation into the parrot sketch is perhaps one of my favorite animated links in the entire series. The idea that we have the Venus de Milo as an animated element dancing, and then she falls off her own shell, and then lands as a physical cutout in a fish tank in the pet shop, is such a fantastic piece of movement between 2D and 3D. That one has always really impressed me. I do love it. But the fact that normally one associates Gilliam's animations with the Python's ability to therefore not have to end a sketch, for it to go into crazy weirdness and then say, well, we don't have to come up with a punchline for this. Whereas there is actually a genuine punchline in the Hermit's sketch.
That's one thing about being a hermit, at least you meet people. Oh yes, I wouldn't go back to public relations.
That's what they come down to as the final reversal is. Oh yeah, that's the worst, having to be facile and talk to people all day after they've just had this insipid conversation about wattles and dung and gossip. It's basically saying it's just as bad, you haven't escaped anything. That's a solid punchline. And yet they still feel the need to undercut that by then having...
You two hermits, stop that sketch. I think it's silly.
What? A whole segment of the idea being that he's interrupting a sketch that's on film, and then we get to see the camera pan to the lights and John Cleese in a robe giving an interview off camera and a bunch of things behind the scenes, which of course always means there are two camera setups. You've got to have a camera setup filming the camera setup in order for that to work.
I was coming up with it's not the fourth wall, it's kind of like the fifth wall, I guess.
Mm. Walls within walls.
Yes, and there's me with half a wall wattled. I mean, what'll I do?
There you go.
So, I forget my point now. Except to say that it's interesting, therefore, that if the traditional structure of Python that's been established over these 8 episodes is that they don't need to have endings and that silliness is encouraged, it is therefore odd that there is this character specifically designed to have transitions by calling out that structure when they already have a tool to ignore it. Is an interesting choice.
Yeah.
Sorry, Gov, we're right out of parrots.
Well, we've mentioned a number of sketches so far in trying to encapsulate this concept. Nathan, what are your favorite sketches of the episode? Do they fall in the ones that have come up, or are they wholly different?
We've covered almost all of them. Almost all of them. But my first one, I tend to go in chronological order because I write them down as I see them.
Okay.
So I'm going to put number one is buying a bed.
We want to buy a bed, please.
I really love how the just obscene distance that Terry Jones has to run, nay, sprint, whilst carrying Carol Cleveland. He's a pretty small guy, but carrying Carol Cleveland across an entire field, down a hill, through traffic, on a sidewalk, that's pretty good. I dig that. Well done, Cherry Jones, for fitness.
One of the interesting premises here, of course, is that the introduction to this sketch is Jones carrying Cleveland over the moors. As a finale from the previous sketch, we have a voiceover, I believe Terry Gilliam, saying,
"But there, let us leave the art critic to strangle his wife and move on to pastures new."
And then the pastures are literal, as we have Terry Jones and Carol Cleveland running across them. The basic premise of the buying a bed sketch is that these are newlyweds. They're so anxious to get a bed because they're finally allowed to have sex now that they're married. Like, that's the underlying tension of the sketch is, God, we want to be able to have a bed. Now we can finally do it. It never comes up. It's just subtext. The fact that they're a bride and groom, that she's in a dress, that he's in a tux with a top hat, it never actually becomes part of the sketch itself. The sketch devolves in a completely different direction to have to do with not saying the word mattress and the fact that you have this weird band of people in this store that are all helping each other out by singing songs and standing on tea chests and covering up the fact that each other has mathematical goofs in their thought processes. There's this this weird community of people that help each other. The initial premise of, oh, I need a bed, because I've married Carol Cleveland, by God.
I'd like to talk to you tonight about the place of the nude in my bed.
None of that actually becomes part of any of it.
The main lead-in to the joke of this sketch, the main line they use is,
perhaps I should have explained, Mr. Verity does tend to...
And then put in absurd linguistic mistake here. I find that to be delicious, to just like a, what a new is going to come along. My only complaint is that they didn't have more of those, but they kind of get into this saying mattress. He puts a bag over his head, and when is he going to say mattress? You're sort of watching the popcorn popping and like, when is the next joke going to come up? I think that's really funny writing. Another complaint is they essentially break their own rule right at the beginning.
Yes.
You know, when he says 60 feet long, he means 6 foot long. They're actually not including their own verbal gaffe in the description of the rule. So it's like an easy improv mistake to make when you're like making rules where you have to say this one thing in a particular way. But to get the rule out, you have to say it in normal English just so everyone can be on the same page.
And I believe it's Eric Idle who plays. The character's name, by the way, is Mr. Verity.
Verity.
So you're right. He has a line that transitions from him calculating numbers correctly.
Yes, you have to remember, of course, to multiply everything Mr. Lambert says by 3. It's nothing he can help you understand. Apart from that, he's perfectly all right.
See, I'm sorry.
To ending with him using his tick of exaggerating everything by a factor of 10.
But it does mean that when he says a bed is 2 foot wide, it is, in fact, 60 feet wide.
But it happens in the middle of the sentence. He ends with his trope. It makes you aware of the fact that they've broken the rules, but at the same time, it means that he lands the punchline in such a way that he's fallen back into his pattern. The audience laughs. The audience, they understand that the rules had to have been broken in order for that to be as funny as it is.
Otherwise, it'd be nonsense. They're just picking random numbers, it would seem.
Right.
Yeah.
What I find interesting is the idea that Lambert doesn't know about the dog kennel slang. He has that intro line once Jones and Cleveland are trying to get his attention. He says,
oh dear, what's he been telling you now?
So he's clearly aware of the fact that in order to protect him, there's been some sort of occasion like this in the past. But dog kennels clearly isn't a code that he's aware of. Or else he wouldn't repeatedly say, go to the pest department on the second floor. The code that Eric Idle's character has come up with doesn't work for him. And I find that they tread that ground a little too flat before they move on. But the escalation of how much work they have to do and the confusion that he's able to say the word mattresses, that he doesn't set himself off. If he were to say the word, he doesn't have to put the bag over his head and be sung to. It's only when somebody else says it, I think, is a good trick. The sketch eventually ends with Cleveland saying the word mattresses after they have literally gotten the entire city of London in stock footage to sing Jerusalem for a verse, all the way up to the penultimate word of the song before he takes the bag off, and then she gets him to put the bag right back on his head because, as she says,
but it's my only line!
Oh, it's
the second of two instances of that joke in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like that joke? Or does it bother you that that's how underused the female characters are in this episode and in general in the show? That the Pythons are basically pointing out, saying, yeah, we get these women on here, we give them a terrible punchline, and then we make them pay for saying it by having everybody verbally abuse them for delivering their bad joke or hurting our characters.
I don't dislike the joke. What I really like is how much Carol Cleveland is invested into essentially squealing like a baby that it is her only line. Because the entire scene up to that point, she is essentially eye candy and she plays the dumb bride just so Jones can explain to her, thereby explaining to us, that no, in fact, we have to divide by 10. Even though we can already do the math in our head. But he's like, no, it's 60 foot long. And she has a quizzical look on her face. And then Jones like, no, 6 foot long. Because like she, I guess, makes it a look that she can't do the math in her head.
It's a good look. I do enjoy her I'm too dumb to do math look. It is it's a piece of acting that somebody else who isn't as funny as Cleveland wouldn't have been able to pull off. But you're right. It is kind of sad that that's basically what she's there for, is to explain simple arithmetic to the audience in case they haven't gotten it.
I think actually those are the Brandenburg gates that they have stock footage of.
Oh, okay. Anyway, I just want to underscore this. I think Wyeth's character, basically repeating her earlier joke from previously when she came in the art critic sketch to offer Michael Palin a jug of Watteau, and she cries so deliciously at having delivered her terrible, terrible line. I think she does it just as well here. I've always found those to be very funny. I do love the subversion. I do love the breaking of the fourth wall.
What a terrible joke!
But it's my only line!
But it did occur to me even more this time watching Round that they're basically just putting women on screen in order to have them fail, which strikes me as a little weak sauce. That they could be doing something more than that.
You know, that makes me think of a photo. There's this great photo, I'm sure you've seen it, of the entire writing team of the Frost Report. This is 1965, 66 maybe. There are, I don't know, maybe like 18 people in the photo.
Mm-hmm.
And a good third of them are women.
Hmm.
And that was peculiar just because I'm so used to, of that time, women being locked out of so much of life that was not, you know, being a mom or maybe being a teacher. So I was proud that the BBC had that forward-thinking social grace, if you will.
Yeah.
But come to the Pythons, they don't have any of that. They just have Kara Cleveland. They've got, you know, women in the production team, but it's Kara Cleveland and a number of other people who essentially do what you just said. They come on for either eye candy or they have one or two lines to prove how bad they are at being smart. I just listened to an interview this week of Eric Idle, and it was actually a Fresh Air interview, I believe back in 99. Terry Gross was interviewing Eric Idle, and she asked, why were there no women in Python? The answer had something to do with the fact that it was so silly, we just didn't think women would find it funny.
Hmm.
Therefore, you can't have a woman writer because she's just not going to have that same sensibility. On top of that, there were other things like, well, you know, people fall in love, then it becomes much more political, and then touchy, and with men you're like, you don't have to deal with any of that. So even though they came from, historically BBC had, you know, a third of its writing staff for the Frost Report be women, and Eric Idle was the first man in the Footlights to put in legislation to allow women to be in the Footlights Club, the very famous comedy factory coming out of Cambridge, it still was an all-guy engine.
Yeah. I have in front of me an article from The Guardian that says before 1974, only 16% of Oxford's undergraduates were women, and that it was therefore in 2014, really only the 40th year, that Oxbridge had been officially co-educational.
Yeah, this used to be a nice neighborhood before the old ladies started moving in.
So when our writers' team of five Oxford graduates were in college, it was not a co-ed environment. They went from boys' secondary schools to a men's college. And I think it's important to remember that it's not just that. I think you're right that the Frost Report being a co-ed writing environment was probably a real step up in terms of giving women, hopefully, equal footing in terms of their ability to pitch sketches for the performers. And that any representation was a good representation, but that when these guys wanted to write and perform their own sketches, they retreated to the environment that they'd come up with, which was the Footlights, which was those clubs on campus, which were entirely men, most likely.
Yeah.
So yeah, 50th anniversary of Monty Python, but not yet the 50th anniversary of Oxbridge being co-ed. So important thing to remember.
Second favorite sketch.
Hit me.
I'm going to go all in on this one. Not only because you and I performed the sketch on stage in high school, not only because it is arguably the most identifiably Monty Python sketch, and not only the fact that it has been parodied by Margaret Thatcher herself and quoted during a 1989 Conservative Party summit where she was talking about essentially the demise of the Liberal Party in British politics. It is because the Dead Parrot sketch is probably one of the best written, best performed sketches in all of Monty Pythondom.
Remarkable bird, the Norwegian blue. Beautiful plumage, isn't it?
Now, with the couple of previous iconic sketches that have come up in the earlier seven episodes, this clocks in at number four in terms of the all-time greats. Aside from Monty Python and the Holy Grail, when people think of Monty Python, they think of the dead parrot sketch. That is the pinnacle of the television notoriety. But before that, we had Nudge Nudge, we had Crunchy Frog, and we had a third thing that has escaped me that in terms of sort of iconic Python things, they're not thick on the ground, but they were all things that were able to be two-handers in the live arena. You're looking for it now, aren't you? Trying to figure out what the other one was.
Well, there's the restaurant sketch, but I'm pretty sure that's not it.
No, it's not. Well, just leave me looking stupid in the recording. That'll be fun.
Hi, this is Ben in the future. Just dropping a brief clip in to say, the lumberjack sketch, obviously.
But my point is that I think, like, as we've discussed each of these sketches previously, we have talked about how did it make a transition into the live performance, and was the live performance potentially, did it reveal something else? And I find that you very specifically said that Crunchy Frog was much more engaging when it was live.
Mm-hmm.
And we also discussed that Eric Idle really leaned in to Nudge Nudge. He really gunned that character up to 11 instead of doing it in the slightly subtler, slightly less manic method in the television delivery. But you're saying here on the screen for Dead Parrot, it's amazing. Do you find that it's not that different from the stage version?
It's a bit different for two reasons. One is, I feel like, for some reason, I don't get this with the other ones, but for Dead Parrot and also for Cheese Shop, John Cleese, who's always playing the John Cleese role, knows when the sketch is going to end, and kind of turns to the audience and then smiles and says thank you and does a bow, which it takes me out of the enjoyment of the sketch. Whereas in this performance, as well as the one on And Now for Something Completely Different, you know, it segues into something else. So he's not drawing attention to the fact that he's actually performing to a watching audience. The same could be said for the Michael Palin character, who is there to receive the brunt of this complaint. I feel sometimes on stage, he plays a little bit to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that. I like it when it's new to them. It's new to the world. They're playing it like a normal sketch, not knowing that it would have such legs that would last them, you know, 50 years later.
Yeah, it is extremely humble in terms of its essential setup, right down to Cleese's god-awful, ugly, semi-transparent raincoat, which is one of the most distracting costume elements I've ever run into, because it's just fascinatingly disgusting, and therefore must have been a thing that was really worn by people in London town. But the prop of the parrot isn't particularly well rendered. The shop is mildly full of stuff. It's not ambitious in its initial setup. And it even diverts somewhat from what you think the sketch is going to be about, with a strange left hook right at the beginning, with Cleese getting Palin's attention and getting him to sort of come out from hiding behind the cash register by misgendering him.
Hello, miss.
What do you mean, miss?
I'm sorry, I have a cold.
I want to draw attention to that for a very brief second. Cleese says later in the sketch, when you sold me this parrot,
what I purchased not half an hour ago from this very boutique.
Therefore, this is a shop he's been in. This is a person he recognizes. And yet, they treat each other like strangers for the first couple of lines. The whole hello, miss thing, he really does seem genuinely confused, as if he's trying to get anybody's attention, and they don't have a connection during those first couple lines. I'm sorry I have a cold is not the answer to the question of, I misgendered you in order to get you to come out from behind the damn cash register. They really do change the stakes of their relationship halfway through the sketch. I don't think it's a deal breaker, but I do think that in the live performance, they're aware of the fact that they've written a sketch where that line doesn't really make any sense, and they push past it with slightly less confusion.
As I recall, when you and I did this sketch in high school, I was the shopkeeper.
Yep.
And I was wearing a wig. I wore a long, shaggy, blonde wig, I think, to justify the line.
Yes.
I don't quite know whose idea that was. I do remember having that, and then once you said, hello, miss, I took the wig off, revealing that, hey, look at me, I'm not a miss, I'm not a lady, I'm Nate.
Yep, that was our way of dealing with it. Again, I think that was because I came to it so much from the audio instead of the television, I couldn't picture the sketch in my head. I couldn't understand what that line meant. I'd listened to it more than I'd seen it. And so we came up with that gag as a way of staying true to the text, but making it have some sort of rationale. I actually talk about that, our performance of that sketch in high school a lot, because I had a strange experience during it, which is at the end, in this version of the sketch, Cleese just turns to camera and says,
"If you want to get anything done in this country, you've got to complain to your blue in the mouth."
A weird variation on the expression blue in the face that I don't understand where it comes from. But in one of the live performances, he goes into this strange aphasic seizure where he goes, "If you want to get anything done in this country, you have to go to your blue in the face." And I was like, what is he doing there? Again, didn't have Live at the Hollywood Bowl, didn't have a physical thing that I could watch. And so I decided to interpret him as basically going into some sort of twisted bodily thing where his whole body contorts in this strange combination of arms and limbs. And as I was doing that on stage, I tripped over my own feet and fell backwards and hit my head against the stage. Now, you were going off stage in order to find out that there were no parrots, so I don't know if you really knew this, but I hit my head so hard that after the sketch was over, I went into the bathroom backstage to try and see what was going on, like how hard did I hit my head, and all this clear mucus from my sinuses was shaken loose and drained out of my face in this astonishing torrent of biological stuff. And a friend of our family's had a previous couple of years had these extreme headaches because she'd actually lost spinal fluid and her brain was resting on the brain pan of her skull. And because I knew this story, I was paranoid that I didn't know what it was. It was just all this clear fluid leaking out of my nose and my mouth. And I was like, my cranial fluid is leaking. I've hit my head so far. I'm going to die. My brain is going to collapse like a whale on the beach. And I'm going to die backstage at my high school because I did a Monty Python sketch.
It's a stiff.
Wow, I do not remember that at all.
And then nothing happened. Well, I think that's why, is because I was like, I just waited to die for about 30 seconds and nothing happened. And so I just went about my life and I'm still alive. So, which is why I eventually came to the conclusion that it must have been, you know, sinus fluids as opposed to cranial fluids. But yeah, I would say one of the scariest experiences of my life happened because we did this sketch live on stage.
Nobody likes a good laugh more than I do.
Funny that you bring up the ending of the sketch, because the end of this sketch, as it is always done live, is not the real ending of the sketch. And I was reminded of this just recently when I watched it. The original sketch is just north of 3 minutes, but it goes on for an extra 2 minutes where he goes into a second parrot shop, which is exactly the same pet shop, except now you have a mustache on the Michael Palin actor. And then he has to go to the railway station. So the sketch actually goes on for quite a bit longer, and they didn't need to do that for the live shows. So they found clever ways of ending it. Either, I got a slug. Does it talk? Yes. Great, I'll have that. Which is how we ended our sketch, I remember. Because I was mortified of saying the alternative, which is, I got a slug. Does it talk? No. Well, it's scarcely a replacement. Do you want to come back to my place? Yep. And then curtains. I was a little bit too bashful to say that in front of our, shall we say, indeterminate conservatism in the audience.
Yeah, I think if we had even pretended to casually out ourselves in front of our mid-90s audience, that would have been a millstone around our social necks for some time. Unfortunately, in the pre-reconstructed queer fear 90s.
This sketch really does not work if Cleese plays it straight. Mm. It might be okay if Palin plays sort of a middle-class person, but him being slightly working-class definitely makes it funnier. But if Cleese doesn't come in with that hyperactive, piercing the lips together way of talking kind of person, I think all the humor would just be lost.
Stand-up comedian Phil Jupitus has a bit about this in his album Quadrophobia, where he talks about the idea that when you are dealing with customer service, you instantly become posher. You go in, I'm paraphrasing him here, so I apologize for stealing his joke, but he comes in and you're like, yeah, hello, mate, I'm here to buy a stereo, you know, you got anything, you know, nice, ordinary man of the people. But the second that somebody, as he says, screws you around, dicks you around, then suddenly it's all, I am the mayor of Casterbridge, and I demand satisfaction in my retail experience. Fetch me your manager immediately! And I think it's in that spirit that Cleese has to come in a holier-than-thou mood in order for him to have the higher ground of demanding that he be treated properly. Whereas if he came in, he's like, oh, I might pull this pair, don't you? What's wrong with it then? He wouldn't have the status to demand satisfaction. But also, let us point out, as we have many times in the course of these episodes, frustrated Cleese is the best Cleese. So
I will say right now that this is how I learned the word palindrome.
Now, what's the other thing which reads the same backwards as forwards?
A palindrome?
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
Yes, I did not know what a palindrome was until this very sketch.
Nathan, your 8th grade algebra teacher is very ashamed. There's no way we didn't do number, wordplay, forward, backwards, palindrome things in pre-algebra.
Well, maybe we did it, but I was either out to lunch or thinking of television or whatever I was doing.
It didn't sink in, regardless.
And I'm pretty sure I'd heard you use the word before, and I was all impressed. But I didn't think then to look it up in a dictionary, which is what you had to do back in those days.
That's right.
Probably because I didn't know how to spell it. But, you know, like the pet shop owner, he didn't know what it was either.
It's true. Hit me with sketch number 3 if we're done with Parrot Shop.
Well, since you brought it up, I just want to point out that Bolt and Ipswich are almost at corner opposites of the country.
This is Bolton, is it?
No, it's Ipswich.
That's Intercity Rail for you.
Ipswich is on the southeast coast.
And Bolton is up near, I totally lost it.
It's right on top of Manchester.
Manchester, thank you. Oh, Manchester, so much to answer for.
So yes, that would be a very terrible detour. Okay, number 3, Hell's Grannies.
I think Hell's Grannies is right on the edge of being iconic. I think it's one of those sketches that people refer to. Unfortunately, because by dint of being filmed, it's one of those things that they can't possibly have recreated. And a lot of the photography in the sketch is very good. They've got the camera placed low and they've got motorcycle stunt doubles whizzing past on either side. It's a very visually effective sketch. And the idea that therefore it would have affected people doesn't surprise me at all. It is, I think, perhaps one of the things from Monty Python's Flying Circus that has entered into the public consciousness to a large degree that has nothing to do with the live shows. But I think even casual fans refer back to this as a sketch that they continue to remember and favorably.
I think this was refilmed for and now for something completely different. And I do remember that one a little bit more. For some reason, I just think it's different filming. I think they redid it for the movie.
Okay.
That's all I have to say about that.
You know how I like to have little theories about where the sketch came from. With this one, it's just the phrase,
senile delinquents,
as opposed to juvenile delinquents. That somebody, you know, was messing with the idea of, yeah, all right, juvenile delinquents, that's a thing that people sort of toss off as a phrase in terms of the comic inversion of strong, upstanding, leather-bound toughs and punks being beaten up by saggy-stomached Michael Palin and his purse and his wig. The visuals are great, and the things that they do with it in terms of, you know, they talk about
pension days are worse, they go mad. As soon as they get their hands on their money, they blow it all on milk, bread, tea, tin of meat for the cat.
There's even a bit of a miming from the mouse problem, where in that, our man who dresses up like a mouse says that it all starts when he was at a party and they started passing cheese around. In Hell's Grannies, there's a line where, you know, me Nan, oh, I thought she was fine at first.
I mean, she used to be quite happy here until she started on the crochet.
So again, that concept of something banal being the beginning of the slippery slope into disaster is nested in this sketch as well. And then it falls apart. It does, in fact, as the Colonel says, get too silly, where they start then having random other occurrences, including the baby snatchers, which is where I believe we get our third guest star, our third listed cast member, Rita Davies. Mm-hmm. And then the vicious gangs of Keep Left signs attacking vickers with improper haircuts.
Hell's Grannies definitely falls into the canon of the show, which is sort of opinions and criticisms of the permissive society. All you have to do is swap in youth for grannies and drugs for crochet. And you essentially have a commentary on what old people think is wrong with permissive society. So it's funny that it's really kind of young people who are talking about old people and how they've gone off the handle. Rita Davies, noted wife of Ian McNaughton, not John Howard Davies, previous producer. As far as I could tell, she is not related to John Howard Davies. But with the addition of Rita, she is the third Davies to appear on the show.
Okay.
You got Rita Davies, John Howard Davies, and production designer Jeremy Davies. I live for these stupid little facts, Ben.
I'm impressed. That's a dotted line that I hadn't noticed. So I assume this is not Jeremy Davies who went on to star on Lost and Justified?
You are correct.
All right. Good. Because otherwise, he has a youthful appearance that men would kill for.
Right.
I believe we've reached the time of the show, Nathan, where it's time to put you through the ringer of the Monty Python Minute.
Bum, ba-dum, bum, bum.
You're in luck. Today's Monty Python Minute is something we haven't really talked about except in the abstract, but it also means that it's early enough in the episode that you're not going to be too troubled by the follow-up trivia part, because Minute 3 is the focus of our Monty Python Minute. So you will then, after the 60 seconds of watching it and the 30 seconds of summarizing it, have to only answer 3 questions in a minute and a half in order to successfully win this round.
Okay. 3.
Minute 3.
Morning, Colonel.
Morning, gentlemen. Now, what can I do for you?
You've got a nice army base there, Colonel.
All right, so Nathan has watched Minute 3, and he has 30 seconds to summarize it, starting now.
Graham Chapman, as a colonel sitting at his desk, gets accosted by the Vercotti brothers, Dino and Luigi, who are small-time gangsters who come offering him money so they don't basically bust up his army by breaking things, and they demonstrate this by throwing ceramic mugs and teacups off of his desk and off his mantle. He seems pretty unfazed by this, but they keep on telling him while blowing smoke in his face that, oh, it'd be a shame if things broke around your base, Colonel. How many tanks you got? I got 500 tanks. And I got ships, and I got air, and I got platoons, and I got parachutists. Yay.
All right. So, speaking of the concept of silly, which the Colonel will end this sketch with by saying that the whole thing has gotten too silly, and besides which, he didn't get any good funny lines, so he's ending this as the ranking officer. You have, over the course of these series of podcasts, on occasion I will refer to a sketch, and you will refer to it by its name in the indexes. The sketches all have official names by which they are cataloged, whereas sometimes I'm referring to them in a more conceptual manner, but you know the actual names of these sketches. There are 10 sketches in the entirety of Monty Python's Flying Circus that have the word silly in their title. 3 of them appear in series 1. So you have a minute and a half to identify 3 silly sketches that we can name. I'm going to tell you what the name is, and you just need to tell me what happens in the sketch. Just like a sentence or a reference that says that you understand. If you can get 3 of them in a minute and a half, then you win. Number 1, silly job interview.
Silly job interview, is this with Good Night? Ding, 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 ding.
It is. Congratulations.
Okay.
Number 2, silly psychiatrist.
A pass.
That's from episode 13, Dr. Larch and Mr. Phelps, where Mr. Phelps is dressed as Napoleon and comes in with a parrot and an empty dog leash.
Oh, God.
Also, out of order, silly voices in the police station.
Ugh. I gotta pass on that one.
Where the police officers can't understand unless you say something to them in a particular voice. So somebody has to say, I'd like to report a burglary!
Okay.
Number 4, episode 14, Ministry of Silly Walks.
This is where Palin goes in to advertise his silly walk to the Minister of Silly Walks. Maybe it could be useful, but it can't.
The Silly Doctor Sketch, episode 21.
Silly Doctor Sketch. I don't, this is where the doctor is Gumby.
No, I'm sorry. This is the Mr. Doctor, where there's just a confusion about names.
Okay.
I believe this sketch is also known as the Interrupted Sketch. you also have the silliest interview in the world, silly disturbances, silly noises. Unfortunately, Nate, I think you came in on 2 out of 3.
Wow. Sorry, everybody. I will be replaced next week.
Well, I think part of the problem with 4 series of show that is predicated, if you believe John Cleese, on the concept of trying to be silly, then describing something as the silly doctor sketch means that you probably have a lot of doctor sketches to choose from. So it was actually a tougher quiz than I gave it initially than I presented it as.
Okay, this is the part of the show where we're talking about our favorite moments. Moments, as you know by this point, is a brief bit of film, cartoon, or sketch comedy that just makes us laugh or chuckle. Good friend Ben, what's your top 5 moment?
I usually try to take these opportunities to mention little bits of sketches that we haven't talked about. With that in mind, I will say I really enjoy Eric Idle's performance as Private Watkins, who comes in to speak to the colonel and say that he wants to quit the army because somebody could get hurt.
Watkins, are you a pacifist?
No, sir, I'm not a pacifist, sir. I'm a coward.
I do love his general feeling that he joined the army because he thought it would be like a big game of playing soldiers in the backyard. And of course, the damning line at the end.
Watkins, why did you join the army?
For the water skiing and for the travel, sir.
Which is an actual satire of the legitimate campaign the American military used prior to Vietnam to get people to enlist. Hmm. Which was, they basically said, you know, sea, air, travel in order to get people to join the military. And then, of course, they did. Which, hence the long quoted joke about being in the army, where you travel to foreign lands, meet interesting people, and kill them.
Okay.
Tell me about one of your 5 moments, Nathan.
There's a moment in Hell's Grannies where I believe mm-hmm. they're burying a dead body in a pile of leaves.
Yeah, they're definitely burying somebody in a pile of leaves. Their motivations are unclear.
Right. I watched that a couple times, and I'm like, it's a little macabre if that's actually a dead body. It looked like it's wearing a policeman's cap. Like it is actually a dead policeman. But I found the brutality of it kind of funny.
My number 3 is just the simple delivery of Dino and Luigi Vercotti speaking to the colonel. Just saying,
fire's happen, colonel.
Things burn.
Previously in this show, I've mentioned that one of my top 5 moments was Graham Chapman talking about how, who amongst us could say we haven't lit fire to some major public building at one time in our lives? I don't want to have the impression that I am some sort of closet pyromaniac by now having this moment thing lingering over the deft plasma touch of the release of fire from crude matter. No, nothing like that. I'm not Donald Sutherland in Backdraft. But I will say that just the way in which, and I'm so glad you pointed out the camera movement in that scene, because it is very interesting blocking the way in which it does its best to keep Idle off camera so he can sit there and not be noticed. And you have the two of them sitting down on either side of the colonel in very limited movement. It makes so much more sense now that you pointed out. I never figured out why that blocking was weird before. But I do love the two of them sort of leaning into him and gently threatening him with the idea that, you know, they're major implements of war and destruction. They're huge battalions of ready-made death might just break.
Number 4, vicious gangs of keep left signs.
And on the roads too,
Vicious gangs of keep left signs.
And specifically, I'm amused by how much Eric Idle braces for impact with a keep left sign, which is basically a person crouched down inside a big fiberglass box, shuffling along at probably no faster than 1 mile per hour. I just like that a lot.
Speaking of Hell's Grannies, I'm going to go in with my fifth moment for the show, which is the graffiti on the wall when the cop comes in and gets the grannies to move off to another location. There's a piece of graffiti there for an actual football team supporting a real league. And then next to that, someone has scrawled, "Make tea, not war." And I just feel like that's obviously an ironic comment with regard to the kind of things that the grannies are interested in based on earlier commentary on what they blow their money on a Thursday night. But as a personal philosophy, as a lifelong tea drinker, I'll drink to that. I support that. I'd buy that magnet. I'd buy that needle point and hang it on my wall. Ladies and gentlemen, make tea, not war.
I would not appear in a frontal nude scene unless it was valid.
This episode of The Python Perspective was conceived, researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. Sound design, also by the Dos de Nu.
Our logo was designed by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song is by John Philip Sousa and was sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community.
You can find us at pythonperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at PythonPod. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of the comic phenomenon known as Monty Python's Flying Circus.
There are things, dates, facts, names, data of any kind that you feel is incorrect. Please contact us via the website, and we'll post it to our errata page on pythonperspective.com as soon as possible.
Once again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation or argument. Probably conversation. I'm Nathan, my co-host is Ben.
But only if it's valid.
We'll see you next time when we discuss Episode 9, The Ant, an Introduction.
As in, this podcast's gonna get lit?
It's gonna blow up like a bomb. We're gonna cut that out. That's stupid.
It was a pun.
Now, what you're thinking of is a little later limited.
Yes, yes, I am. What's perhaps more interesting is... I'm sorry, that's rude.